Yeah, I think the biggest piece of that comes with being at the table.
Welcome to NPD Soundbites from ANPD, the Association for Nursing Professional Development.
This is the NPD Forecast. Your hosts, Jen Bodine and Jillian Russell, are nursing professional development specialists with years of dynamic NPD experience. Jen and Jill round out ANPD's Nursing Professional Development Practice Team and are your personal environmental scanning forecasters. This podcast series features topics that are relevant to the forecasting of future trends for NPD practice and discusses implications that you can apply to your daily practice.
Welcome, everyone, to the NPD Forecast. I'm Jillian Russell.
And I'm Jen Bodine. Joining us today to speak about the role of learning facilitator is Mandy Walker, a director for ANPD's Board of Directors. Mandy has 17 years of experience as a nurse, with the last 12 in NPD. She's a leader of professional development and nursing excellence of U of L Health. She has her DNP in executive leadership from American Sentinel University. She obtained her MSN in nursing education from Walden University and her BSN from the University of Louisville. She is certified in NPD, critical care, and as a nurse executive. She has been published in peer review articles and presented locally, regionally, and nationally on topics that include critical care, simulation, and professional development. She's currently in her second elected term on the ANPD board and was appointed to the Kentucky Board of Nursing in 2019. She is the 2015 recipient of the Belinda E. Putz Award for ANPD. Mandy, we're super excited to have you on with us today to speak about one of the key roles of the NPD practitioner, learning facilitator.
Thanks. I am very happy to be here.
So, Mandy, we'd like to give our listeners a little bit of background on the role of the learning facilitator. Obviously, we know that this is, in fact, one of the many hats that we as NPD practitioners wear, that of the learning facilitator. And in this role, the NPD practitioner uses the educational design process to bridge the knowledge, skills, and/or practice gap identified through a needs assessment. And that's straight from our scope and standards of practice. In fact, standards 1 through 6 in the NPD scope and standards of practice outline competencies for NPD practitioners who fulfill the role of the learning facilitator through use of the educational design process. To analyze this role, we will take a look at each standard, some of the associated competencies, and then we'll discuss with you the implications and strategies for performing these competencies. Mandy, could you start off by telling us about your journey into the specialty of NPD and how you had first learned about the educational design process?
Yeah. So I think my journey is probably similar to a lot. I started clinically, started precepting people and really enjoyed teaching, really enjoyed students, and kind of doing that one-on-one instruction at the bedside and really starting, to watch those people then grow and develop in their careers. And about 5 years into my career, it actually was kind of funny. I was a charge nurse at the time and I was in charge of the schedule and they kept moving. I was in an ICU. They kept moving the date of critical care class around and I kept having to like rearrange all the new hires' schedules to meet critical care class so that they could go. And I got really annoyed because literally every week they were changing it. And I went downstairs to the educator and said, "What is going on? Like, I can't keep moving these people's schedules around." And she said, "Well, we're down one position. We don't have a critical care educator and I'm having to move it to meet other people's availability." And I was like, "Do you need me to teach? Like, would that help?" And she was like, "Well, we do have an open position. Are you interested?" So I was about 16 hours into my nursing education master's at the time. And so I went upstairs, talked to my boss, applied, got the job. And so, that's kind of how I slid in at that point. It was in my to-do list, but at the time I was still focused at the bedside. But it was just funny. And so coming into that role, the supervisor I had at the time, who's my mentor now, and we still have a fantastic relationship, really had kind of our onboarding process to the MPD role set up in such a way that you had to do a project, which was essentially walking through that education design process. So you had to go and do a needs assessment, and then you had to identify what are the standards or the, you know, norms that they need to meet and where are those gaps. And then you had to design an education initiative to address those gaps, evaluate it, the whole nine yards, and you had to do it all within your first year as an MPD. So that really introduced me to what is that role and what is the design process right off the bat.
So Mandy, I chuckle a little because I got my jobs in a similar way. My first education job, I went in to interview for an ED position, flexi night nurse. And they saw that I had my MSN in education and they were like, hey, we have a better idea for you. But the worrisome thing was I didn't find my MSN prepared me for that role. I feel like it prepared me more to operate at the academic level versus it within the hospital setting. So I was so relieved. Now I'm embarrassed to say 3 years later, I found AMPD and realized that there was an educational design process. And it was such a relief to me that that existed and finally gave me some guidance with what I was doing. And I can't even imagine the like patchwork of education and the trail of despair I left behind because I didn't know what I was doing for the first 3 years.
Yeah.
I'm okay now. But I want to start from the beginning because I think that's an important, you know, thing for us to go through. And that's, you had mentioned the assessment of practice gaps. Can you give us an example of how MPD practitioners in general and you specifically analyze issues, trends, and data to determine the needs of your target audience?
Yeah, I think the biggest piece of that comes with being at the table. You have to be at the table on the front end. You have to be plugged in all different levels of the organization. So you need to have MPD practitioners or leaders, MPD leaders, you know, plugged in at those senior level meetings. You need to have them, all of the committee meetings, all of the quality audits, your root cause analysis or parent cause, whatever, you know, terms you're using for those things. Wherever we're trying to do, you know, quality improvement or we're tracking data, especially nurse sensitive data, MPD practitioners need to be at those tables and helping evaluate that. And then they need to be at the staff level. They need to be out and they need to be among, they need to be observing. And really, then you kind of pull all of that together or in silos, depending on, you know, where the issues are, to really do that comprehensive analysis. And then you're going to find probably 100 things and you can't do 100 things. So then how do you prioritize what those practice gaps are? And some of that may be, you know, prioritizing quick wins, things that you can accomplish quickly. And then some things may be, you know, more involved, but ultimately get you a bigger bang for your buck. And so how do we kind of navigate those things? But really, you have to be seen as a partner to those out on the floor. And that's kind of something I'm actually kind of dealing with in a leadership role right now is I think all MPD practitioners will say we're there to grow and support and to augment the bedside. And like our whole job is to make things easier there for the staff to deliver care, to make sure they have what they need, the knowledge and the skills and everything that they need. But sometimes when we're pushing because things aren't, practice isn't ideal, we kind of butt up against each other. And so, you know, especially in today's world right now with our resurgence of COVID, especially in the area I'm at, you know, everyone's stretched to the max. And so it's finding that balance too of what do we need to do? Where is there potential for harm? Where is there those issues? Where do we have kind of our biggest things we need to tackle and balancing that with, do we have the bandwidth to do it? Both on our MPD side, but then also on the staff side.
It's such a tough balance to find that sweet spot for, I think I like to call it strategic and purposeful environmental scanning to support that needs assessment process. But then to be very mindful of how does that truly translate to frontline staff? And I love the word augment how can we really live that as NPD practitioners? How can we embody that, and how can we make that happen in a meaningful way that translates appropriately? One of the resources that I'd like to mention is ANPD's Environmental Scanning Toolkit. And this is available to our members through the Tools and Resources tab. And this is a spreadsheet with a lengthy list of resources that we can use as NPD practitioners, really at the national and international level, to help inform our own environmental scanning efforts. Also, this podcast, the NPD Forecast, also strategically named, is an environmental scanning tool for NPD practitioners to use to support their practice and their needs assessment process that they do on a daily basis. So thank you so much for sharing more about how you and your work, how you assess practice gaps. Moving on to standard two, the identification of learning needs. Andy, how do NPD practitioners collect data to validate an identified gap in practice, specifically to drill down to whether there is a knowledge, skill, or practice, or maybe a combination of the three? How can we drill down to identify where that gap really lies?
You know, it's not, again, it's not just one thing. I think the default always comes back to, especially with leaders, other leaders, to the knowledge gap or the skill gap. And I really feel the need a lot of times to dig deeper and to push back when they come and say, you know, we identified this one person did this one thing wrong, and we've all been in those situations. And they think it's a bigger issue, is I ask for proof. So I need proof that this is a broad issue. I need proof that it's goes deeper than one person maybe not following policy or procedure or correct practice. And you can get that in any number of ways. Obviously, direct observation of practice. You know, when people know they're being observed, they usually do it right. And if they do it right while they're being observed and they don't do it right when they're not, we're beyond a knowledge gap and a practice gap. But when people do things incorrectly when being observed, then you know definitely, you know, that there's something missing there, that they are not, you know, all the pieces aren't clicking. And whether or not that's an actual skill issue, like they don't know all the steps, or maybe it's they don't know the importance of not cutting corners or skipping certain steps. And where does that lie? Or is it more of a practice issue in that? And I'll tell you one thing that we know has fallen off during when staffing and census is what it is and acuity is what it is, stuff like oral care and pericare. You know, is it more of a practice issue? Because they literally can't get to it. And so then how can we help them? So then the knowledge gap isn't that they're supposed to do those things. It may be time management. It may be prioritization of care. It may just be reports. I remember when I was at the bedside, if there was something I didn't get to because there just wasn't enough time in my shift, that was the first thing I told the next person coming on. And maybe that's something that's not happening. You know, they're not passing off from shift to shift tasks that weren't accomplished. And is that where the education or the, you know, where we need to address it? I think we need to look at issues in a 360 degree comprehensive process, because what we think is the problem as to why they are not doing expected practice may not be the actual problem. And, you know, just re-educating to the process may not fix what is actually causing the breakdown in practice.
Mandy, I like that you said that, because I think educators often have to deal with ideal versus real, because we have to work within the constraints of our environment. And right now with the pandemic, it's like the environment has become even more constraining. And I think educators need to be very flexible and adaptable to look at the acuity of the situation and what are the things that we have to do right because of patient safety versus the things that we can get back to when we get more even keeled. And I think that's really hard for educators because we want things to be the right way. So this is, I think, a tough time to be an educator trying to follow a process.
Very much so. And people are very resistant to even listening right now. You know, they don't, they don't want to hear it. They're barely keeping their head above water, whether that's at home and at work and the combination of all of it. And yeah, it's a difficult environment right now.
It is. And I think educators, we often fall into that role of the supportive person, you know, that come in your office and sit there for 2 hours and they'll just kind of vomit their issues to you. And this is one of the times when it's really good to have that role with what's going on in with healthcare and nurse burnout and whatnot. So I am grateful that we are often looked at like that, but this is, yeah, it's a tough time. And it's hard for people to prioritize education, but again, we always have to worry about patient safety.
Jen, I'd also like to comment on the importance of really focusing on system versus process issues. And if we are able to identify those opportunities early on to make a difference and have that impact, whether it's a system or process issue that can improve workflow and mitigate a potential gap in knowledge, skill, or practice, that is so important for us as NPD practitioners, as educators, to be proactive in not only our educational design process, but then having that ability to collaboratively work with other stakeholders to improve workflow, system, process issues. So thank you, Mandy, for mentioning that as it relates to true identification of learning needs, because there may not be a true learning need. It could, in fact, be that systems or process issue that we can help support and mitigate.
That's a great point, Jill. Thanks for making that. We're going to go ahead and we're going to proceed on to standard number 3. And this is one of my favorites. And I'm always kind of, you know, pounding my fist at this: outcomes identification. Those outcomes, you can have them in your mind from the get-go, what you want to achieve. And I probably hold this so dear in my heart because, like I said, I spent so many years not even thinking about the outcomes. So now I'm really embracing it. So can you talk a little bit about how NPD practitioners identify desired outcomes of an educational plan?
Yeah. And you know, we're all taught in school or in practice, you know, you need to start with your objective or where do you want to end up and work backwards from there. But identifying that, not just learning objective, but the outcome that you're looking for. So there should be, at the end of whatever it is you're doing, if it's patient care focused, there should be a change in patient outcome. So not just, you know, that we're looking at streamlining or adhering to a better practice, but what is the change in patient outcome? So what are we, you know, is that an infection rate? Is it a fall rate? Is it a, you know, whatever that may be, you need to choose that and you need to be specific about it. And you need to always ensure that whatever you are implementing is going to drive that. And then if it doesn't, you're going to have to circle back around to it. So to back up from there, so you have that outcome, then you should have a practice change. So what is the practice change that we expect to hit that outcome? And then what is the education or the gap that needs to drive that practice change? And you just work your way back from that. The return on investment, which is kind of evaluation level 5, I usually do a proposed. So if I am going to drop CAUTI rate by 5% or whatever it is, I can calculate by unit what kind of a return on investment that would be based on, okay, if everyone's going to do a 30-minute module, hate them, but they have their place. But, you know, so we're going to have everyone do 30 minutes of education. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. If we can drop CAUTI by 5%, what's our return on investment? I can propose that on the front end. And then on the back end, I need to follow up and see, did that actually work? Was my return on investment what I said it was going to be? Or was my return on investment better, worse? One of the examples, and they got frustrated with me, is we're in an optimization of our EMR right now. And the EMR company put forth a proposal for like how they could rework the admission assessment and how it could reduce nurses' time to do admissions and do all that work. And, you know, it would save X amount of time, you know, over the course of a year per nurse. That amount of time was less than the time it was going to take to educate them on the changes. And when I brought that up, and we were going to pay them, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to do this work, plus the tens of thousands of dollars it was going to cost to educate the nurses on the changes we were making to the EHR. And their ROI, when I brought that up, was negative, and they were not happy with me. They were like, well, we don't calculate in the education time into our ROI. And I'm like, but why? You're going to have everyone, literally, it was, they'll save on average by nurse by the end of the year, less than 15 minutes. And they were going to do 30 minutes of education. And I was like, hold, please. So it's really thinking comprehensively about it all. Obviously, I love the goal of reducing nurses' time and documentation, because that increases nurses' time in care. But we need to think about it holistically as we're putting that plan together.
So, return on investment. I think it is such an important thing for NPD practitioners to understand business acumen, to be able to communicate to senior leadership. Can you speak a little bit more to the importance of that? And as far as you obviously speak that language.
Yeah.
How has that made you more successful because you're able to use that language? Because there's probably a ton of us who don't know how to use that language.
So, yeah, ultimately, healthcare is a business, and ultimately decisions are made at the higher levels. Yes, I truly believe, and I come out of a nonprofit, but I truly believe that everyone is in healthcare for the right reasons, ultimately to, you know, provide optimal care and outcomes for our patients. But it is a business, and decisions are made. I call them the bean counters. A lot of decisions are just made based on how much money do we have and how many resources, you know, it's scarcity of resources or resource allocation. And so if you can speak their language, if you can put together business plans, proposals, calculate out what you think a project or a program or a new position can do for the organization, and attach that to, and sometimes they'll call them theoretical dollars. And unfortunately, a lot of what we do in NPD can be in theoretical dollars. But if we can drive those actual outcomes, like we're talking about infection rates, fall rates, things we know have a cost that is calculable, it makes it even better. But, you know, everyone's in a turnover crunch right now. So if you can find, you know, a golden ticket to reduce turnover, that's easily calculable. And then if I follow up and show that I actually did it, the next time I propose it, I have proof of concept of things that I have been able to do and actually follow through on to drive outcomes at the organization. One, and then you get credibility. And when they know you can talk their language and you can articulate your point and your meaning behind what you want to do, they do start listening to you more. And it makes every subsequent proposal that much easier moving forward.
So not only do you have a seat at the table, but you get to keep your seat at the table.
Right.
Awesome.
As it relates to ROI, there is a particular resource that ANPD currently has available, again, in the Tools and Resources tab, and that is the Known Costs Table. So this is an updated resource that anyone can use to inform that conversation with stakeholders as it relates to cost savings. So, for example, the national average for the cost of CAUTI, or the average cost for losing a nurse as it relates to turnover and retention. There are pages and pages of known costs articulated in this table, and I encourage anyone listening to seek out that resource to arm yourself as you prepare to have conversations with leadership and other stakeholders in your organization.
Absolutely. And, you know, calculating those sorts of things, the math that goes into it, you know, putting calculations into an Excel sheet and all those things are not, usually naturally in the wheelhouse or in the of an NPD practitioner. You know, that is not something that always comes naturally to them, but there is probably somebody, at least one in your department, but if not in your department, then in your facility, who loves that kind of thing and then loves to show other people how to do it. And so always start small, you know, don't go crazy your first one. And then it kind of grows and develops like any skill that you may have. Just do it, get with people who know how to do it and help them and have them help you really start to develop that skill of looking at something and then looking down the road, you know, 2 years, 3 years, because sometimes that's what it would really take to get back your return on investment. What does that actually look like? And then work your way back, but use those resources that you've got for sure.
That's a great point, Mandy. It doesn't happen overnight, ROI or development of that skill. So something that I want to mention that I've noticed as we've begun to talk through these standards is we're beginning to weave a consistent thread and building continuity of identifying a gap, labeling that gap appropriately, and having an outcome. And how do you bridge that consistent thread throughout? Standard four is that of planning. And I think it goes without saying that the act of planning encompasses several steps to really be successful. However, Mandy, I'm curious, what best practices could you offer our listeners as it relates to establishing a plan to achieve expected outcomes?
So yeah, and that really comes back to once you've identified that gap and that outcome is what is the desired practice change or practice that you're trying to address? You know, is it psychomotor? Is it cognitive? Is it interpersonal? What are those things? And then you need to choose something, you know, when you're looking at your Bloom's taxonomy and you're looking at your active education opportunities, what can I do to actually drive that? You know, sometimes it can be a highly interactive module with good little video clips that may drive things home and then, you know, make them think and work their way through. It may be some role playing. It may be simulation. It may be something a little more didactic if it has to get really technical and you need to talk through what those things are that are technical in there. Or maybe it's a blend of it. Maybe I give them the really technical things up front and then I bring them in and we do case studies and role playing and simulation to kind of drive home the point. But I really do think it depends on what your gap is. You need to identify an intervention that leads itself to that change that you're looking to see. So if it's in physical skills, then I need to get them in there and get their hands on it. If it's in critical thinking, then I need to design something that's going to enhance the critical thinking. And so that may be games and it may be different things like that. But it really does come down to what is your problem. There is no one solution for everything. You know, I've seen amazing online modules that really do everything, but I need to get my hands on that piece of equipment so that I can actually, you know, mess with it a little bit before I use it on a patient. And so, you know, what are those opportunities to really match my intervention with the outcome I want?
I find this is really the area where educators are also able to use their creativity, both their creativity as far as engaging their learners, but also their creativity as far as resources, because I'm a military spouse. So I've worked across the country and I've worked with very, very poor healthcare systems where we were doing simulation on baby dolls we got from Goodwill. And then I went to work in California where they had a high fidelity sim man stuffed in a closet somewhere that I found and they just forgot about him. Can you believe that? But this is where we really get to show just how great we are at our jobs with that adaptability to our resources. So you had some really great points there. Thank you so much. And then I'm going to go into standard five in three parts because standard five has three sections. We've got we implement the plan with Standard 5, and that's through coordination and facilitation of a positive learning environment and practice environments. And Mandy, I really want to speak to that because I think it's just so important, especially in today's world. And then finally, consultation, which is typically the competencies that we see with an NPD specialist. Mandy, would you mind discussing some of the strategies you use to facilitate a positive learning and practice environment?
Yeah. You know, obviously having a good attitude and just being open and listening is a big piece. You know, I'm not a bubbly kind of wow in your face, you know, let's cheerleader type public speaker. That's just not who I am. I'm very much more kind of down to earth. Let me pull up a chair and let's have a discussion kind of type of a teacher, if that's the way you want it to be. It's more of a collaborative learning environment. You know, I usually start out by talking to them that I am much more concerned about the fact that they're thinking through what we're there to learn and that they are active and participating than that they have the right answer. And so, you know, making it okay to be wrong and okay to learn and discuss amongst ourselves can make a really big difference in their outcomes on the back end. So, you know, if I'm up there and I'm like, Susie, what's a normal cardiac output? And Susie doesn't know. And I put her on the spot and I make her feel, you know, a little bit inferior, then Susie's probably not going to speak up. And so really just making it fun. And from that standpoint of they can speak up, they can dialogue with each other, they can maybe work their way towards the right answer together instead of feeling like they have it's black and white and it's right and wrong. But I do think a lot of it comes with how you set up before they ever get to class. So having positive communication about things that are coming, like here's what to expect, here's where you're going to be, you know, dress comfortably if that's what it needs to be or whatever those things are, so that they come into class with the right mindset. Because if they come in thinking they're making me go to another class and this is stupid and I don't want to be here. And, you know, if they have that attitude walking in, it's that much harder once they're there. So really creating that environment is starting out on the front end with a good collaborative relationship with them, with their leaders, with everyone else who is in the class or who may be coming to the class, and really probably promoting whatever it is as a positive thing for the organization as well, that it's not just one more thing they're making people do. And then letting them see the outcomes. And I think that is, you know, a big piece of it when they get back upstairs and if we're monitoring, you know, outcomes and processes and seeing that there was a change and coming back to them and saying, hey, you know how we did this last month? Well, look at what our results were this month. Look at the outcome that we had. So that maybe next time, again, you're building that relationship so that next time when they come back, they see showing up to these things as a positive and that there's going to be results at the end and they're going to see those. That's important.
I like that you said that, kind of getting on board with the positive message, because I've heard and probably been guilty of saying myself in the past, like, hey, we've got to do this. It's just got to happen. Instead of pointing out the why we need to do this, why it's important, how you get a positive outcome from it. Because like you said, most people are in healthcare because they want to help people. So if we can talk about how our education helps them help people, they are a little more receptive to it.
Yeah.
Can you speak a little to how you provide support to your staff as they navigate the educational design process?
MPD practitioners?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I have right now probably almost a dozen in the health system that have less than a year of experience, all the way running a gamut from some who started less than a month ago, you know, all the way up kind of through that. And then people who have been in MPD for 20 plus years. So I've kind of got a wide variety of those. And it really, I vary my approach to the person. Some people really like to bring you every step and like, here's what I'm thinking, give me feedback. And so I'll provide that feedback. Some people like to come with a product kind of already complete and then, you know, tweak it instead of coming at every step. I will say that one of the things I found, you have to find a balance as a leader. And I don't think any NPD practitioner likes to be micromanaged, but it's finding that balance of kind of staying on top of what they're doing and understanding, you know, their thought processes, but still allowing them to do it. When I was a new leader, you know, I had just come from the NPD role. I was actually orienting my replacement while I was also their manager, you know, so there was a lot of that kind of going on. And, you know, I had assigned somebody, you know, a new responsibility, and a lot of times wanted to control how that was done because I wanted it to be done a certain way. And it took time and it took practice to be like, I'm going to tell you where I want you to be, what the end result is. And then if you need feedback along the way, please come and get it. But more than half the time, they did it a way I wouldn't have done it. And it was better than I would have done it. And so I had to learn to kind of let go of that control and to learn that that innovation, they do actually joke around, a couple of them who still are in the system and, you know, maybe aren't in NPD anymore, but joke around that I'm going to say no when they first come in with a new idea. And I don't do this as much more because I've learned, but they would be like, Manny's going to say no. And then she's going to come back to you in a couple of days and she's going to say, so I've been thinking about what you said. And maybe if we came about it, you know, do this a little different, this a little different, I think it's doable. And so when that person was kind of joking with a new person to tell them, Mandy's going to tell you no. And I kind of got that feedback and started thinking about it. I was like, you know, I do tend to do that. So now I pull the mom move, which I'm not a mom, but I pull the mom move and I'm like, well, let me think about that. And then I go and do my 2 days of thinking, and then we come back and we'll talk about it again and maybe find a different approach, you know, because there's usually a valid reason why I don't think specifically what they're proposing will work, you know, whether there's a barrier, a systems issue, something that it won't work, but a very close version of that will, if we mitigate this one issue. And so I've learned in my growth and my development to let the people who I've hired to do a job do their job, and to be creative and to think about things outside the box. And if they're being maybe a little too in the box, then my job is to push them outside the box. And so I've kind of got both. I've got some I've got to like, let's bring it in. And then I've got some that I've got to push out. So, you know, you have to vary your approach by people, by person. So
reflection is very key to being a good leader. Because we still have to, even when you achieve that, you still have to be able to grow.
Oh, yeah.
So that's great that not a lot of people are able to achieve that. So that's awesome. So I'm going to lead us on to the final step in the educational design process, standard six. And I find it's often the forgotten step because we'll do all this, you know, we'll assess the gap, we'll do our learning needs, we'll plan and we'll implement. And then somehow evaluation gets shoved off to the side.
Yeah.
But then how do you prove those outcomes? So can you speak a little bit to what best practices you can offer relating to evaluation?
Yes. So I think it needs to be multimodal, first of all. So there needs to be, you know, depending on what your initiative is or your intervention is, you know, if it's kind of a one and done, doing a formative evaluation can be a little bit difficult. But if we're talking about something a little bit more long-term, like a transition to practice program or an entire onboarding process or whatever that is, there are a lot of different ways to get that formative feedback, whether it's from, you know, a formal evaluation in a class of how that class went, you know, whether there were snacks, whatever, you know, and walk through all of that stuff. Or it's looking at how that class went. You know, it's evaluating, sitting down, and when you're done with the class and saying, so what went well, what didn't go well, class took a left turn here, but it actually ended up in where I needed it to be. And is that actually something that I want to now build into the class because it was an interesting discussion? And really, you know, it's multimodal. So am I hitting that outcome that I was intending for? Absolutely. And I do think we fall down on that. I think we implement it, and maybe even for a month or two, we monitor whatever that outcome was. And then 2 years later, they're like, hey, look, they're not doing this anymore. And you're like, well, why? I don't know why we taught them 2 years ago. That's what they were supposed to be doing. But we didn't pay attention to it. We didn't have a sustainment plan in place that didn't to go along with it. But then also, you know, you can hit an outcome perhaps without the best process. So you also need to do that evaluation of how, you know, did my intervention, my education modality, my education design, was it the best to get the outcome? Maybe you got the outcome and great, but you still have opportunity to improve that process. And maybe the other way around, you didn't hit your outcome. So let's come back and let's see why and let's see what that was. But I think, you know, I say to people, I don't care if they liked it. I don't care if they thought it was enjoyable. I do. Ultimately, I care about the outcome, but, you know, it's really about the whole picture of what we're doing. And was it worth all the time, all the effort that was put into it? And did it get us to where we needed to be?
Well, I think you've just identified a step 7 for the educational design model. When we're going to call it the Walker educational design model, step 7, sustainability.
Right.
Because that is so important. That's how we end up having to teach hand washing over and over again, because we fail to do sustainability. That's fantastic. Thank you so much. I love those answers.
I saw a picture on LinkedIn and everyone was in costume.
Yeah, I'll tell you about that. So we had a game in the midst of it, and it was kind of, we pulled some of it from the scope and standards and some of it from like an MPD review and all that kind of stuff. But it sparked a debate because some of the questions were, they read out the definition of one of the roles of the MPD practitioner, and you had to, like, a team had to like ring in and, you know, like Jeopardy or whatever, and say what that role was. And they called it the educator role. And they said, no, you're wrong. It's the learning facilitator role. And half the people in the room were like, what's the difference? And it really got me thinking as we were prepping for this, why we changed the name from the educator role or the educator competency to the learning facilitator, because that educator role, to me, and I think to a lot of us, connotates that person standing up in front of a classroom, teaching and imparting knowledge down to people in a more formal setting. Whereas that learning facilitator role is really the person designing some sort of an education or an offering or an intervention that makes the learner actively participate in that outcome. And I think we really need to work with MPD practitioners and leaders and staff to really change that perception of, you know, the language we're trying to switch from educator to nursing professional development practitioner and educator to learning facilitator. I am not here pushing knowledge out at you. It is a collaboration to elevate the level of knowledge and competence of everybody around us. And I think I really like the term learning facilitator for that reason.
I feel like I'm going to need to do a mind blown sound effect here, because that's such a great way to explain the difference between the two.
So it sparked a debate. So that was our debate. They still were mad they got the question wrong in the middle of the game. But I think that's a nuance that not everybody has gotten, you know, really in this shift. I think we get it from a practical standpoint of how we're teaching, and I'm going to use that term teaching loosely, but I don't think when they're thinking of their role and their competency, that shift has actually happened. We think it's our job to make sure they learned it. And now our job is to facilitate their opportunity to learn it.
Mandy, thank you so much for taking the time to join Jen and I today. This was such great conversation on the role of the learning facilitator. We really appreciate you being here with us. And listeners, thank you for taking the time out of your day to be a part of this conversation as well. I'd like to recap a number of resources that we've mentioned throughout today's episode in addition to a few resources that we did not have a chance to plug throughout the episode, both the Environmental Scanning Toolkit and the Known Cost Table are available at www.anpd.org. Navigate to the Tools and Resources tab and then select the NPD Practitioner Resources option. You'll find both of those documents available for download there, free to members. Also available in our online store are a number of resources related to the educational design process and the role of the learning facilitator. A foundational resource that I would recommend any NPD practitioner and any NPD team to have available to them is the core curriculum. Also, we have a number of quick reference guides that really expand upon various components of the educational design process, our leadership text, and then finally, two online courses. The first, Planning Quality Continuing Education, an expansion of the steps of the educational design process, really providing you an overview of evidence-based steps for planning high-quality continuing education programs. And also the Transition to NPD Practice Fellowship. This is a 13-module program for the novice NPD practitioner, dissecting the roles and responsibility of NPD using the scope and standards that are really required for successful NPD practice. And then finally, listeners, I'd like to direct you to our discussion board for comments. If you have any other questions or comments regarding the role of the learning facilitator, please post on this thread in the podcast discussion forum. You can access this through the Tools and Resources tab at www.anpd.org. Choose the podcast forum and you will see this episode's topic, NPD Role Learning Facilitator. You can listen to our podcast series by subscribing to the NPD Forecast on the ANPD website on the podcast page or wherever you stream your favorite podcasts via Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or iHeartRadio.
This NPD Forecast series analyzes information gathered through environmental scanning. Our goal at ANPD is to be your leading resource for NPD practice. If you like what you hear, please leave a 5-star rating on your preferred podcast platform, as well as a review. And if you feel so inclined, share with your friends and colleagues on social media. Be sure to tag ANPD when you do. Those ratings and reviews help us grow this platform and extend our reach. As NPD practitioners, we know our strength is in our sense of community. So the more you share the NPD Forecast, the more valuable this environmental scanning resource will be. We would love to hear from you and encourage you to post podcast topic recommendations in the podcast discussion forum available on our website.
Thanks for listening. For more information, visit our website at anpd.org.